Brother Ray will be taking us on a sea journey, a trip through the Rome. Brother Ray.
I'm sure you are all kind of caught up in the same feelings and emotions as I am this morning. It has been a very touching and a very meaningful experience. I say touching, just that little opportunity to hear our young folks, children, in that sweet little way, testifying to their belief is edifying. But this morning, to witness another baptismal service is always so a memorable experience for me. For me, it's one of the highlights of any gathering or conventions that we might have together to have the opportunity to welcome into our midst two more who are devoting their lives to God and who have publicly testified by their act of immersion. And as I stood by the poolside, I thought of another consecration, a more dramatic one perhaps. It was on a dusty road on leading into the capital city of Damascus. And there was a fiery zealot, one Saul of Tarsus, who was on a mission to destroy the heresy of these new Christians. And as he approached, he was confronted by the resurrected Lord. And at that moment, his consecration was so revealed when he uttered, in a complete abandonment, "Lord, what will thou have me to do?" And there, in his consecrated state, he was led for 3 days in a blind condition, waiting for what next step the Lord had for him. You remember, in accepting that consecration, how God did ask Ananias, one of the Christians in Damascus, to minister to the needs of Saul, and to then tell him what the Lord did want him to do. And remember, Ananias was very reluctant. He wondered about the mission. He knew that this man was bent on literally rooting out all those who believed in the new way, in the Master. And the Lord had to reassure him that, yes, he is my anointed. He is my servant. Let us just get the dialogue. And Ananias answered, "Lord, I've heard many things of this man, how much evil he hath done to the saints at Jerusalem. And here he hath authority from the chief priests to bind all them that are on in thy way." But the Lord said unto him, "Go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how great things he must suffer for my sake." There is the man in which God accepted the consecration of Saul of Tarsus. His heart was right with God. He was in a consecrated state, but his mind had to be changed. He had to know now the new and the living way which had been opened up by the Master. And so there begun the career of one who probably was next to our Master in service and in adoration to God. And for the next 30-odd years, that mission was being carried out. He was to bear now witness before kings. He was to go before the Gentiles. He was to go before the children of Israel, letting them know of this new and living way. And we would like to open then our narrative of the journey to Paul at the latter end of that career, in which he was now going to have the supreme fulfillment of that commission, to now go before the royal imperial throne of Rome, and there to witness his faith in the resurrected Christ. Remember, just by way of the preliminary, how he was brought to that state, that God in his providence was leading him to the climax of his work. He had a little altercation in Ephesus, in Jerusalem, where he was charged with causing a disturbance in the temple. And remember, he was apprehended. He was kept in confinement for almost 2 years by a politician who was on the take, who wanted bribes, and his name was Felix. And when he was turned over to another successor, there was Festus, and he, another servant of Rome, only intent upon keeping peace and just keeping his job secure. he was going to make an arrangement with the hierarchy of the Jews. So now they're going to try Paul. Yes, they are going to give him his justice, but they're going to have a change of venue. They're going to extradite him from Caesarea now to Jerusalem. And there it was decided. Paul knew that once he got into a kangaroo court, in which he would not have a fair opportunity to witness or to present his case, he made an appeal. I appeal to Caesar. As a Roman citizen, he had every right to do that. This was the Supreme Court of the Empire. And thus, in the exercise of his Roman citizenship, it was Festus who said to Pilate, you have appealed, and to Pilate you will go. Then you remember how Festus, he wanted to know a little bit more about how he should phrase or frame his charges as he sent the now prisoner to Rome. He called in Bernice and Agrippa, King Agrippa, who were visiting. And you remember that very dramatic appearance between the two, how Paul's testimony was so vital, so strong, so much a part of him, that, remember, Agrippa said, Paul, art thou trying to make me a Christian? And so Agrippa said, yes, in private to Festus, this man, not guilty of any crime, he should be let free. Why are you holding him? But since he appealed to Caesar, we have no choice. He's got to go to Caesar. You see, it was the fulfillment of God's arrangement. He was destined to give this witness in the highest authority of places, and he was willing and happy to do so, even at the peril and knowledge that probably would be the end of his life. So, we take up the narrative, in which now he's transferred, his custody is transferred from the jailer now into a centurion, a Roman guard, and he was responsible for the safe delivery of the prisoner to the prison in Rome. And I want you all to turn with me to the 27th chapter of the book of Acts. You know, I've often wondered about that book, that chapter. We just look at it, and it just seems to be like one of the most interesting, fascinating adventure stories. Probably one of the most interesting of all sea dramas. And no fiction writer could improve on the drama and the seriousness of the occasion. And as we turn to the 27th chapter, I want you to come with me, and we will put ourselves in the boat with Paul and with his party, and then we'll see if there's any spiritual applications that we might make. We will kind of leapfrog through the preliminaries. In the first verse, we read that when it was necessary or determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners under one named Julius, the centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship of Adramyttium, he launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia, one Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon. And Julius courteously entreated Paul, gave him liberty to go to his friends to refresh himself. There we would like to pause just to make some brief observations. You see that he was now transferred to a centurion who was of the Augustus band. And evidently the Augustus band, by its title, was seen to be one who was more closely linked to the Emperor Augustus, perhaps as a part of his Praetorian Guard, perhaps a part of the bodyguards or the trusted battalions that were specially commissioned by Augustus. And as he was shipping aboard the vessel, and as they were sailing, they touched their first little port of stopping. And it says that they touched upon Sidon, and there Julius gave Paul courtesy of a shore leave. First of all, we would like to say, who is the manifest of passengers? Well, it says here that we, and Luke, Dr. Luke, who is the author of the book of Acts, obviously was including himself, but there was Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Macedonia, being with us. We don't have time to go into the career of Aristarchus, but he was one who could be counted upon. He was a servant of to Paul and a co-worker of the most loyal sort. And when Paul was intended to be the victim, it was Aristarchus who took the punishment. And it was Aristarchus who was arrested. Paul was shielded from an experience that might have even then prematurely threatened his life. It is curious, I've always wondered, why Julian, a centurion now, who would be responsible for the safe delivery of this prisoner, wouldn't allow a prisoner who was in shackles to go ashore to refresh himself. You realize what this meant for Paul. Here, Julius knew that if Paul would escape, or if Paul were anyway not safely delivered, Julius' life would immediately be required. That was the law of the land. But here, Julius apparently had such confidence that he allowed Paul for a day to be at liberty and free. That day was so meaningful. I can just picture what it meant to Paul in the experiences that followed. And I can picture what it must have meant to those dear brethren at Sidon who must have been at dockside waiting for him or knowing of his arrival. What a glorious day they must have had together. We talk about sweet fellowship here, how they must have just reveled in the zeal, the love, and the comfort, and the message of joy that Paul just radiated. And I can just imagine as he was going back to the boat, ready to embark. They all accompanied him to the warp side. That is, they were just waving at the dock side goodbye to each other. Many, many tears flowed. I wondered why Julius, you know, was overruled by the Lord, because this refreshment meant much to him and to the brethren. I wonder perhaps why Julius was so prompted. And I would just suggest that Julius, being a centurion, might have been in contact with other centurions. You know, there were three centurions mentioned in the scriptures that around this period. There was a centurion that was at the cross of Jesus who said, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And there was another centurion, and he was not too far away from where they were. And he was one Cornelius, the first Gentile convert. It may be that somewhere in the officers' club, Julius and Cornelius or some other one may have just talked about this new faith. And somehow Julius knew that there's something different about these people, these Christians, and especially about this Paul. But then we see, and I'm going to skip over the next several verses, because here we have a real geography lesson. We had a chart here, we could just trace the entire voyage that he had from the western tip of Asia Minor, or the most eastern point of the Mediterranean Sea, and just went right around across the boot of Italy and to his final destination that people arrive at. And that is one of the beauties of the Bible. This is one of the proofs of the Bible, that the very point, the very places that are mentioned in this account are to this very day being able to be identified. They know exactly where the places are. This is not any conjecture. This is not any fiction. Compared with what has been accepted so much Greek classical literature, Homer's Odyssey or the Iliad, which points out various places in the Mediterranean where supposedly these warriors may have had their episodes and their adventures. Those places cannot be identified. They were merely figments of imagination. And how the critics and the agnostics would love to be able to point out to any point in Scripture and say that this is not true, and they would try to undermine the integrity of the Scripture. But nowhere, in spite of their efforts to try to disclaim any point of geography, you see how this account just verifies the veracity of God's truth and God's word. So we will just kind of skip down to the ninth verse. And we will just mention in passing that this is a time of year in which there was an ominous fear in this part of the Mediterranean. All the seamen knew that this was the time of a very dangerous wind. You know, here in Canada, out in Labrador and around Newfoundland in that area, I know where they do a lot of fishing, cod fishing. I'm told that they are in constant dread of what they call the northeasterly. These gales that come down in the fall of the year or the winter period, and which they can be, with some suddenness, they can be very treacherous and very dangerous. And many a ship has been lost along that coast because of this unpredictable weather. Today, with radar and all the modern meteorological means, it is minimized. But 100 years ago, the areas off some of the Labrador coast were called graveyards for ships. So these sudden storms would suddenly come up, and captains would try to elude them or at least anticipate them and run for the safety of harbor. And so here it's called. It was coming, as the account puts it, coming to the time of fast, F-A-S-T. That fast related to the Feast of Atonement, the Atonement Day sacrifices. It was on the 10th day of the 7th month. And so it was getting close to that October season when the storms in this region were threatening. And so that was their danger. And now as we open up the 9th verse, we read, "Now when there was much time was spent and when sailing was now dangerous because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished them and said, 'Sirs, I perceive that the voyage will be with much hurt and much damage, not only of the lading and the ship, but also of our lives. And nevertheless, the centurion believed the master and the owner of the ship more than those things which were spoken by Paul. And because the haven was not commodious to winter in, the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means they might attain to Phoenice, and there to winter, which is in a haven of Crete that lieth toward the south, west, and northwest.'" Well, it merely then tells us that here Paul had a premonition. Paul had a revelation by God that now we're going to be in some danger if we proceed. And he did warn the captain, he warned the owner, that for whatever orders they may have had, ostensibly to go to a safer harbor to the west and to kind of crawl along the island of Crete, the shores land of Crete, hoping to get a little further back towards their ultimate destination. And Paul then warns about this danger. Now the captain may have thought, well, what does Paul know about all of this? He's just a landlubber. He's just the one who is just a prisoner. Why or how should we listen to him? But you know, if the captain knew the credentials of Paul, when I say credentials, I mean by the experiences of Paul. Paul was well acquainted with the dangers of the ocean. And I'm just trying to see if we can just quote a little from the 10th chapter of the book of 2 Corinthians, or 11th chapter, in which he enumerates some of the difficulties in which he faced and the sufferings that he endured. Let me just read a little portion. He says, and this is the 28th verse of the 11th chapter, "Twice was I beaten with rods, I was stoned, and once was I stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck. At night and a day I have been in the deep. I have been in perils of the deep," and so forth. Three shipwrecks. Suffered a night and a day in the deep. He had a healthy respect for the sea. And because of his experiences, he urged them not to pursue. But whatever motive, profit or otherwise, they decided to go ahead. And now is where I ask of you to change our focus a little bit. That we will imagine ourselves now in that boat with Paul. And that the boat is the ship of state. We are now living in Canada, in the Canadian society and the Canadian government. And we are safely aboard. I would ask now that we picture ourselves with Paul and Aristarchus and Dr. Luke, and now undergo with them the same experience. And I would just have a little preliminary that we place ourselves in 2004, in that state. And I would want to read to the suggested comment of Brother Russell and the October 16 manner, just to give us the kind of frame of reference, for we are in the ship of state now. He maketh the storm a calm, Psalms 107:29. We of today represent the Lord's cause in the midst of the raging elements of human passions, oppositions, and so forth. And our hearts would be at times dismayed, except as faith is able to see the Lord with us in the ship, and able to grasp the thought of his mighty power in his own time and way to speak peace to the world. It would not surprise us, however, if a dark hour is before us, if the time shall come when the stormy winds will be so fierce that many will cry out in fear and trembling. Let us learn well the precious experiences of the present time, so that then our faith will not fail us, so that in the darkest hour we shall be able to sing and to rejoice in him who loved us and bought us with his own precious blood, and to sing the song of Moses and the Lamb. And so with that frame of reference, we now plunge to the next verses. And here we find them quickly coming to us in the 13th verse. And when the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, they loosened hence, that is, they weighed anchor, they sailed close by Crete. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euroclodon. And when the ship was caught, it could not bear up into the wind, and we let her drive. And coming under a certain island, which is called Florida, we had much work to come by the boat, which when they had taken up, they used help, undergirded the ship, fearing lest they should fall into the quicksand, they straked the sail, and so were driven. And as we were being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day we lightened the ship. Now just get the quick, almost electric action, series of action. They came out of the port, and it was a nice soft wind blowing. They supposed the south wind would bring them right to their next stop along the southern part of Crete, till they came to the most extreme west part, and there they would hope to at least have a better harbor or move further. And suddenly, as they just cleared the harbor, a forceful gale, a tornado, a hurricane just seemed to grab that vessel. And with full sail, they were just caught up in that storm. And with desperation, the crew tried to take down the sails. They tried to hold the ship together. The cargo was probably just going all over the vessel, not tied down. They needed, in desperate ways, to safety the ship, or to make the ship seaworthy. And in the midst of that, they were now caught in a storm which they could not steer the vessel, but they just had to be driven by the tides and by the wind. Oh, how do we now in that ship make an application of that? You know, the sea, according to the scriptures in Isaiah, is representative of a turbulent, angry people. Sea is a picture of the lawless restlessness. And as we get in the second psalm, as we get in the 46th psalm, we see how a time will come when the seas will be boiling, as it were, and the seas will overcome, and will just overwhelm all of the surface of the land. We wish we could read those texts, but time always is of the essence. So sea then represents the boiling restlessness of mankind. And we are in the ship of state, in the society in which we live. And now we find ourselves in a great time of trouble. But there was a time when it was just a soft wind blowing. And I submit, dear friends, that time was 1914. There was a time when it was very calm and placid. I believe that it was in 1898 when the Kiel Canal in Jutland, Germany, and Denmark was cut through, that the nations of Europe had a naval display in which all of the vessels of these various powers were paraded as a tribute to the opening of the canal. And the dreadnoughts, the battleships, those were the ultimate weapons of the day. They were all there, and each nation was proud to show its military prowess. And as they paraded through, they were making a pledge. We will pledge that we will not fire any of these cannons now at each other in any act of hostility, because now we have parity, we have peace, and we will have a peace of world. Yes, they were all saying at that era, in the early part of the 20th century, they were all saying peace and safety. But then suddenly, on an April morning in a little obscure town of Sarajevo, which has been lately, you know, in the news with Yugoslavia and now I think is the capital of Croatia, but in that little town of Sarajevo, there was visiting the Archduke Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he was the heir apparent to the throne. And one shot rang out, and the Archduke was dead. And there resulted from that an incident, a series of diplomatic blunders, diplomatic steps that historians to this very day do not know how it came about. But each step escalated, and each step got more and more complicated until in August of that very same year, a few short months later, broke out and erupted World War I, 1914, the end of an era. The time had come. God's time clock had smitten. Peace and safety, they said. But now the tempestuous currents of war and of cyclonic and tumultuous flooding is upon the world and has never ceased since. And so we find ourselves in this world. And as we do so, those who are in the ship of state with us are trying to stabilize the world situation, trying to keep society together, trying to preserve and save civilization through the First World War, the Hitler regime, Second World War, Holocaust, and then thinking then the United Nations and the League of Nations, they were going to patch together some kind of a peaceful arrangement, only to find that there was then the Cold War that followed, only to find that in that Cold War there was the Korean War and then there was the Indonesian War in Asia. And now we're getting into the war of terrorism. They were coming from the age of anxiety, now they're into the age of terror, and soon to be followed by the age of anarchy and tempestuous seas. We find ourselves in that vessel. And what did they have to do? Well, the 18th floor tells us, and then being exceedingly tossed with a tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. And the third day we cast out with our own hand the tackling of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. Just get the picture of their utter desperate plight. They were in a condition where they were just helpless. They were worse than a cork bobbing in a tempestuous ocean. And in desperation, all they could think of was to maintain buoyancy, to keep afloat, just keep ourselves from being overwhelmed and flooded by the ship. And I'm sure the ship was beginning to take water. The timbers were beginning to show the stress of the continuous pounding of the waves. We know that because earlier on they put undergirding of the ship, and that was where they put straps around the hull to try to hold it intact and keep the seams from bursting. And so now they had to go further. They had to lighten the ship. They had to throw overboard all that was not essential. And, you know, they threw away the packing of the ship. That is even some of the essentials in order to keep buoyancy and to keep afloat. You know, what a lesson is for us today, then. We are on board that ship. And, you know, Paul had to throw overboard his possessions, too. We know that because when he was in prison, he was riding back to the brethren, bring parchment and the cloak that I left. And he had to lose all that he had as well. And I think that is such a lesson for us. We have so much. We live in such an affluent society. And you know, Sometimes the devil uses all of our prosperity in such a way that he gets more effective results than if we were in the abject poverty. My mother always used to say, the devil catches more flies with honey than with vinegar. And then I think about brethren in Romania, or in Moldova, or in the African nations of Nigeria and Ghana. They are so poor, they have very little. And they look at Americans. I've heard it said that some brethren in Romania said, there can't be any more Christians in America. Why? Where are their suffering? Where is their suffering coming from? Everything with them is so easy. We at least have, we suffered through communism. We suffered through a war on our territories. But you know, the devil can be more effective in accomplishing his will amongst a more prosperous society than with one in which, when there were perils, they brethren would come together. The brethren would stand alone and support one another. And all the little personality problems and pettiness, or little points in which we may not be quite so clear upon, but all seem to be secondary. They would all come together for mutual support and help. You know, brethren, we can sometimes be tested more dearly by the things that we have, and the Lord is going to hold us accountable for everything that we do possess. We're going to have to give an account for all the goodies, the riches, and the comfort that we have. What have we done with them? Are we using them to serve in the Lord, or are we using them to serve the human part of our lives? Well, we then see that after so many days, they then saw the helplessness of their position. And it was for 13 days, and then the we thought fog over some of the account here. It was on the 14th day and the 27th verse we will go to. Then on the 14th day, night was down to come, as we were driven up and down in Adria about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country. Now, can you imagine, for 14 days, being in this condition? Now, I've been in a hurricane, and I know what it is to be bobbing about, and I know what it is to be seasick for a day or two, but to be seasick for 14 days, and to be in that condition of the horizon just moving in every which direction all the time, is pretty disconcerting. But after 14 days, Paul, I'm sorry, I should back up a little bit. Just before that 14th day, Paul then gives an issue of hope. Paul said the Lord appeared to him that night. And it's the 24th verse. Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that dwell with thee. Wherefore, sir, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be even as it was told us. That was just the night before, and what beautiful words they are, and what lessons it has for me. Here now, Paul received the message from God. He said, there is salvation. There is safety. We are going to be saved. And now, cheer up. And what I love, that he uses the vocabulary of the Master. Be of good cheer. He could turn, you know, I think the 13th chapter of Matthew, when he was walking on the waters, and the disciples saw him there, and they were afraid. They didn't know who he was. And then, what was his message again? Be of good cheer. It is the Lord. And then, I think John makes reference to that. We shall be persecuted, but be of good cheer. I am with you. That phrase, be of good cheer. How we should be now telling all about us to be of good cheer. That we know that there is a land. We're going to get there, as Paul said. We're going to be there, and on that land there's going to be deliverance. We're going to be saved out of this peril, out of our fear of death here. Be of good cheer. We know God has the divine plan of the ages. We know that there's a kingdom. And if anybody who can tell about it, it was a Bible student. Paul was happy to declare that message to all those passengers, number 267, aboard that vessel. Be of good cheer. How much more should we be saying to the world of mankind? Be of good cheer. But then, you see, the very next day, they had reason to see and have hope. Because the very next morning, as we have just read in the 27th verse, they determined that they were coming to a near country. Maybe they saw a little bird or a gull flying. Maybe they saw some trees or debris from land in the water. But whatever it was, it is said they drew near to some country. But of course, as you're drawing near to another country, it may also add more peril. Because you know, when you just draw near to a land, you are not certain about the terrain. Could there be shoals? Could there be quicksand? Could there be a wreck? Could there be a sandbar? And so what did they do? Well, it said in the 29th acre, and they sounded and found at 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little further, they sounded again and found 15 fathoms. Then fearing that they should have fallen upon rock, they cast four anchors out of the stern and rift for the day. Now just get the picture. As they knew they were approaching land, they didn't know what to expect. So they sounded. And sounding was simply going out to the bow of the ship and dropping a line and putting up that line and seeing the markers. When it hit the land, the bottom of the ocean, they would then count the number of fathoms that they had taken to hit the bottom. You know, in America, there was a man who did that very thing. As a boy, he wanted to be a captain. In fact, he was living along the Mississippi River. And he, as a boy, just loved the waterfront and would watch those Mississippi little paddle boats going down towards New Orleans. And at age 15, I believe, he got a job on board one of those paddle boats. And his job was to go to the prow of the ship, take this little, like we would call like a tape measure, and drop it at various points along the way to let the captain know the depth of the water. And when he would hear and learn the depth, he would shout up to the captain on the bridge, "Mark Twain." That would tell him that he was within a certain distance, which would tell him that he's in the proper channel. So Mark Twain became the pen name of Mark Twain, the poet, the author, and he wrote such popular books as Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and he got his training, as it were, his plot, many of those books, from his experience along that Mississippi River. But he was sounding the waters, just as these seamen were sounding the waters for this ship. Now, how do we sound the waters? How do we know where we are, how close we are to our haven, our land? Why, of course, it's chronology that tells us this, isn't it? It's chronology that tells us how close we are. Well, chronology was able to sound the waves in 1799, and then there was 1874, and then 1914. The scriptures sound the waves. The scriptures tell us how close we are to land. The scriptures give us the assurance of where we are in the stream of time and how we can have confidence in God's chronometer, in God's timekeeping, so that we know where we are in the streams of time and what we should be doing and how we should be proclaiming that good cheer to all men. And then we find that as they were coming near the island, they saw that they were getting perilously close, from 20 down to 15, and fearful of coming on rock, they cast four anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. What symbolism might we apply to that act? The purpose of the anchors was to keep them from drifting on to the rocks. And so four anchors were put astern to hold them fast, at least until the morning, where they could see the situation. I would suggest, dear friends, that for us now living at this time, there are four anchors out there, and they are found for us in the 7th chapter of the book of Revelation. Do not read them, but you will recall how Revelation 7 answers a question that was put forth by the Revelation 6, who is able? And who are they? And then Revelation 7 tells us who they are. But it opens up by pointing out what will happen, that there would become four angels. And the four angels are holding back the wind, so that the winds might not hurt the earth or the trees, until the 144,000 are sealed in their forehead. I submit that God has put four anchors into history to hold back conditions of coming to land until the saints are sealed in their forehead. And we find that the sealing in the forehead, not merely an intellectual perception, it includes all of that and more, because the perception and the impression, as we had heard earlier this morning in that beautiful baptismal talk, that the intellect is not merely, that consecration is not merely filling up the intellect, but it is filling up the character. It is the imprint, the character of Christ, which our intellectual perception is intended to instill, that determines the fidelity and the overcoming of the 144,000. And thus, the Lord is holding, angels are holding back the wind, and the winds are blowing harder and harder. I sometimes am sympathetic to those angels, and I want to project myself into their position. And if I were holding back those winds, and it was getting with increasing pressure, I would be saying, Brother Luke, please, take your calling election sure. Please be more faithful each day. Please, would you not consecrate more faithfully? Would you not sacrifice more consistently? As the pressures increase, sometimes we go through life, we go through the day. We think each day, you know, we take it as it comes. We just aimlessly almost accept whatever happens instead of working together with God, instead of getting our daily marching orders and learning what to expect of us, the effect of us, and to give ourselves wholly to these things. Oh, brethren, what this lesson is telling me is to quicken your pace and to really hasten your work that the Lord is giving you to do. We're in that ship, and that ship, you know, is in peril. And we all long for the kingdom. We pray, thy kingdom come. But, you know, we can hasten that kingdom by joining the 144 faithful, chosen, the called, and the faithful ones on the other side. So we can just lay that upon your hearts, dear brethren, and I don't know mine. But then we see that they saw in the daytime that where they were, and they were by an island. Island which we can identify very clearly as being the island of Malta. It's now, I believe, a nation, independent nation all of its own. And on that island, they found a refuge. But we will not be able to tell you how they found it, other than to say that everybody was rescued. Everybody got off this vessel, but the vessel itself was completely demolished. In the account, when we started in the early part of the chapter, the ship used one word which meant a vessel, a sea-going ship. When we get to the latter part of the vessel, of the account, the word that's used for ship merely signifies a wreck or a derelict. It was so completely shattered and destroyed. There was nothing left of it, just an empty hulk. But the passengers all were able to get to the safety of Malta. And they're doing the ghost some very interesting experiences as well. We know that God has a plan of salvation. And at the present evil order, present society, and democracy and whatever other form of government it is unable to give the desire of all nations. But God has the solution. And thank God that we are in the ship. Thank God that we have the message of hope and salvation. And as Paul went